Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by Boston University's History Department titled The Phoenix Century, Myths of Rebirth from the Ashes of World War II. Our speaker is British author and historian Keith Lowe. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, History Department Chair Bruce Shulman.
It is my great pleasure on behalf of my colleagues to welcome you to this, the second event in a year-long series of public lectures devoted to rethinking the 20th century. I should explain that this enterprise reflects our belief that time is now ripe for taking stock of the 20th century and renewing its relevance to contemporary politics and culture. Because although we think we know the 20th century as a period defined by the bloody world wars, by the clash of contending political ideologies, by the ultimate triumph of liberal democracy against the challenges of fascism and communism, although we possess something like a standard narrative of 20th century global history, the bitter divides of the 20th century are already seeming quaint in our contemporary world, especially to the young people among us. So our purpose over the course of this year is to try to identify broad themes, to explore new approaches, things that will prompt us to rethink how we understand, how we tell the stories, and even how we teach the history of the 20th century world. Well, we can think of no better person to offer original insight into this seemingly familiar topic than tonight's speaker. British novelist and historian Keith Lowe studied at the University of Manchester and spent a dozen years working in the publishing industry before he embarked on his present career as a writer and scholar. He is the author of two works of fiction, Tunnel Vision, first in 2001, which was shortlisted for the Authors Club First Novel Award, and involves a man who must ride through each and every one of the London Underground stops in a single day or else, and I won't give away what the or else is so that you'll still want to read the book, and a second novel in 2005, New Free Chocolate Sex. He is also the author of two remarkable works of history, Inferno, The Devastation of Hamburg, published in 2007, and in 2012, Savage Continent, a prize-winning account of Europe in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. His remarks for tonight are entitled Phoenix Century, Myths of Rebirth from the Ashes of World War II. Please join me in welcoming Keith Lowe.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for coming today. As you just heard, the purpose of this series of lectures is to find new ways of looking at the 20th century, which makes sense to 21st century students. Now, what I want to argue today is that we already have new ways of looking at the 20th century, which already makes sense to most of us. It's just that most historians haven't quite noticed this yet, or rather, let me put it another way, they have noticed, of course they've noticed, but they haven't quite formalized what it is that they see. For decades, historians have held on to an old way of looking at the century, which sticks more or less rigidly to the formal start and end dates, 1900 to the year 2000. But the rest of the world doesn't follow set models, and it doesn't really care much about start and end dates. What it does care about is stories and symbols that it can grab hold of and remember. So what I want to do here today is to explore a little bit about what those stories are, what those symbols are, and what the 20th century means to us on a sort of emotional level, and how we remember it today. And to give you a kind of idea of the sort of approach that I'm going to take, I want you to all try a little exercise for me. I want you to take a look back at your own life and try to remember your teenage years. Then I want you to imagine that you're going to describe these teenage years to some kind of confidant, and it could be a priest or a therapist or just some enigmatic stranger you've met in a bar or a coffee shop. Your task is to explain to them what your teenage years were, what they meant to you. Now, you could simply give them the dates. Your teenage years began when you were 13 and they ended on your 20th birthday. But that doesn't really tell them very much. Birthdays are rarely significant events by themselves. I don't even remember my 13th birthday, and I have to say the only significant thing about my 20th birthday was the massive hangover that I woke up with the next day. On the whole, nobody really concerns themselves too much about the start and end dates when they describe their teenage years. All you really want to express is what was important about them. So what was important about those years to you? Did you simply spend the whole time studying? I sincerely hope not. When you describe your life in this way, suddenly the specific dates of your teenage years don't really seem to matter anymore. If your abiding memory is of arguing with your brothers and sisters, then this is unlikely to have started when you first turned 13. There would have already been a history of arguments beforehand, and let's face it, the arguments are likely to have had consequences that lasted long afterwards. Perhaps this part of your life was coloured by an event that didn't even happen in your teenage years. I mean, for example, a child might lose its parents at the age of 12 or 11 or 10, but his or her teenage years would still be filled with a sense of their loss. Or maybe something happened to you that renders the whole concept of being a teenager redundant. Now, these are the same kinds of consideration that come up when we collectively try to describe a collective period of our history, in this case, the 20th century. There are numerous ways that we can define the century. We could, for example, stick rigidly to the dictionary definition, January the 1st, 1900 to December the 31st, 1999. But once again, these dates don't really tell us very much. January the 1st, 1900 is not an important event. It's just a random date with no real significance at all. Or we could do what we do with our own individual histories. We could try to pick out the important themes of the century and highlight the stories and events that shaped and defined our lives. This might involve blurring the edges of the century a little, but you know, most of us can live with that. We might call this model of the century, this view, that we could call it the sort of the tapestry view of the century. It's a view which interweaves a variety of different themes to create a bigger picture. But this too gives us a few problems. I mean, unlike our own individual stories, defining the 20th century involves not just one person, but billions of people. In fact, over 6 billion by the time the century came to an end. Any set of themes that we choose to describe the century will not have the same significance for all of those people in all of those different regions of the world. A third way that we could characterize the century is to say, well, you know, if we have all these different themes that are going on, why don't we just take the midpoint of the century, somewhere around 1950 or dare I say it, 1945, and evaluate all the different themes that are important to the world at that point. Then we can show how these themes arose in the years that led up to that point and then receded again afterwards, a bit like the bell curve of a normal distribution graph. But of course, this is an even more problematic idea because, you know, 1945 wasn't a typical year, but an anomaly. 1950 wasn't much better. Many of the themes that seemed important in 1950 bore no relation at all to the themes that were important in 1930. History never moves in straight lines or smooth curves. It makes sudden leaps and unexpected dives, and perhaps no century demonstrates this better than the 20th century. The final way that we could characterize this period is to imagine it in the same way that my old schoolmate, Neeraj, looks back on his life. The 20th century was split in two by a global catastrophe that few people saw coming. Even those who did see it coming had no idea quite how disastrous it would be. The Second World War was not just another event. It changed everything. It affected the global economy, the global political system, the environment. It affected art and literature and architecture and philosophy. It affected all of the stories that we told about ourselves. It affected our entire collective psychology. This is the way that I feel we look back at the 20th century. From a social psychological point of view, there was no single 20th century. There was only a period before the Second World War and a period after. Now, the analogy that I'm making here between an individual story and world history might seem like a facile one, but it's not. Ever since the 1940s and 50s, group analysts have been drawing similar analogies between individual psychology and group psychology. Groups, they say, have personalities too. They're affected by events just as individuals are. They suffer collective traumas. They experience collective victories. They have enemies and allies just like individuals do, and they experience collective emotions about things that many of their individual members might not have personally experienced. The largest groups that most people identify with are, of course, national groups. You only need to watch an event at the Olympic Games or a soccer match in the World Cup to see how strongly people feel about the collective fortunes of their own individual nations. But some of us also identify ourselves with larger groups still, by race, or by religion, or by political affiliation. Some even identify themselves with the region of the world that they come from. The European Union is a perfect example. Right at the top end of this scale is the largest group there is, the global community. And this is represented, if any, such a large group can possibly be represented, by the United Nations. Now, all of these groups, at every different level, have personalities of their own, and they have collective memories that define who they think they are. When they think back to the 20th century, what many of these groups remember, particularly the large groups, is the Second World War. But they don't quite remember it in the same way that historians do. I mean, on the whole, they're not so much concerned with the historical sweep that led to the Second World War or the long and complicated consequences that came afterwards. What they recall, in fact, what they're fixated on, is the war itself. The war, and particularly the injuries that it caused, is the single traumatic event that defines everything else. At every important anniversary of the war, world leaders gather to commemorate it and to make speeches. At the recent anniversary of D-Day, for example, 17 heads of state took time out of their schedules to come and spend the day at Normandy. 17. This included Barack Obama, Vladimir Putin, the Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, and so on. From Britain, we sent not only our Prime Minister, but also Queen Elizabeth II, now in her 90s, and largely retired from public life. Now, what other international event can do this? I mean, even international summits struggle to get so many world leaders in one place at the same time. My question is, why? What is it that they think? What is it that we all think it is that we're remembering? There are many answers to this question, and of course not everybody's remembering the same thing at the same time. But there are some things which have always been, and which still are, pretty universal. First and foremost, the Second World War is remembered as a trauma, the greatest catastrophe in human history, as some of our best-selling historians have called it. Approximately 60 million people were killed between 1937 and 1945. And that's actually a fairly conservative estimate. There are some historians put the figure at much higher. Now, any of us that have suffered a death in the family, never mind a violent death, knows how significant an event it can be. The closer that we are to someone who was killed, the more devastating it feels. But even if we aren't close to them, we still experience it as a shock. All of these millions and upon millions of deaths meant that in 1945, almost everyone on the planet was personally affected to some degree or another, and tens of millions of us were deep in mourning. At a group level, the loss was also experienced with differing intensities. Some communities escaped virtually unscathed, while others were decimated. Brazil, for example, only suffered about 2,000 casualties during the war, whereas Poland suffered 6 million. That's one in six of its population. Ukraine suffered even worse, losing perhaps one in five of its population. And as we all know, a third of the world's Jews were killed during the war. Now, all of these deaths not only affected individuals and communities and nations, they also affected us at the highest level of all, the global level. 60 million people in 1945 represented about 2.5% of the world's population. And that's a massive chunk taken out of our demography. When you also factor in the tens of millions of people who were wounded in the war, left malnourished by it, rendered homeless, or violently expelled or displaced, then the effect was even greater. The trauma of the war was deeply felt by this single global community that we call humanity. But there's something else. It was not only the sheer volume of these deaths that was traumatic, but also the manner of them. So many killings were carried out with such cruelty, with such disregard for the written and unwritten rules of war, and in the end, with such totality that they were doubly difficult to come to terms with. Many people didn't just lose a single loved one, they lost their entire families, or sometimes their entire communities. Murder is difficult enough to cope with, but mass murder, genocide, that's something else altogether. I was struck by one story told by a little Jewish girl in Ukraine who was saved from the Holocaust by her Christian neighbours. And to hide her identity, she had to go to church every week. And every week, she would apologise to her Jewish God because she sincerely believed that she was the last Jew alive. Now, one of the things that really grabbed me about that story is the passing similarity that it had to another story of another little girl thousands of miles away in Hiroshima. When she saw all her friends and family and neighbours and so on killed in an instant by the atomic bomb, she too sincerely believed that everyone else in the world but her was dead. Now, stories like this have an emotional resonance that you can't help but take away with you, even if you yourself did not experience it. Any researcher who immerses themselves in eyewitness accounts of the war will come across the same stories again and again. And the phrases that people use to describe what they've been through begin to seem painfully familiar. People say it was hell on earth, that it was like the end of the world, or even a world of death. And they use religious imagery like Sodom and Gomorrah, or Noah's flood, or Vishnu's scorching of the universe. And this applies across the board, whether you're reading the words of military men or government officials or civilians. Even professional writers use the same phrases and the same metaphors about the end of the world and lament the fact that they can find no other language to describe the things that they've seen. Now, these are the kinds of stories and images that are reproduced again and again in all our thousands of TV documentaries about the war and all our thousands of history books, and even in the speeches that politicians make at places like Normandy. It's impossible to come away from reading or hearing about such things without the impression that what happened between 1937 and 1945 was some kind of apocalypse. Now, all of this mythical or religious language is also reproduced at a group level. But in the process, a kind of transformation takes place. Group analysts have always noticed the way that groups can act like a kind of magnifying glass, concentrating emotions and focusing them on specific individuals or people or ideas. When groups or nations look back on the Second World War, particularly groups that have suffered, they not only emphasize their victimhood, they also begin to endow it with a kind of reverence and a real significance, such a significance that it becomes transformed into something almost sacred. Victims become martyrs. Their memoirs become sacred texts. And the sites where massacres took place are transformed into holy ground. It's as if the religious and the mythical metaphors used by traumatized people have become reified somehow by the focusing qualities of the group. Now, this sacralization of the most traumatic events of the war has taken place in every area of our lives. All across Europe and Asia, there are memorials and plaques and monuments commemorating atrocities. Streets and squares and government buildings are named after national martyrs who died during the war. Even our calendars are littered with anniversaries, which give us an excuse to tell the stories of the war again and again, year after year. Every nation has its holy sites and its holy days. In France, perhaps the greatest symbol of the war is the village of Oradour-sur-Glane, which saw the massacre of its entire population in 1944. And today, the ruins of the village are preserved exactly as they were on the day of the atrocity, and they are an official national monument. In the Czech Republic, they have a similar monument in the village of Lidice, where a similar massacre took place. The Poles, they remember the razing of Warsaw, and they now have a huge, brand new museum devoted to it. The Chinese remember the massacre of Nanjing, and only this year have devoted a new official day of remembrance to it. And I could go on. Every country has its holy places and times and dates related to the war, and these are accumulating and being added to all the time. Academics call these places and objects and dates lieux de mémoire, repositories for memories or fragments of memories which remind groups of their Second World War victimhood. But we don't need academic terminology to understand the intense feelings that these things evoke. It's the feeling that we get when we enter the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, which has been described as a cathedral to the Holocaust. It's the feeling that we get when we see the holy relics of the war, like those clocks that stopped at the exact moment of the atomic blast in Hiroshima. And it's the feeling that we get when we meet survivors of any of the most tragic or the most violent moments of the war. We venerate such people as if they were saints, even as we shiver to imagine the things that they must have seen. These feelings are dark and visceral, even in those of us who have no national or religious or political connection to them. But the closer you are to these lieux de mémoire, and the more intensely you identify yourself with the group who was victimized, the more powerful your feelings become. The emotions that are associated with Second World War victimhood should never be underestimated, even though they're borrowed feelings, really. They are experienced as something personal, and they have the power to move nations. The problem with victimhood like this is that it requires a perpetrator. And just as groups elevate victims to the status of martyrs, so they elevate perpetrators into monsters. And there's certainly no shortage of monsters and demons when it comes to the Second World War. I want to read you a description of Europe now, written in March 1945, which I think think, neatly summarizes all the local rivalries that were awakened by the war in Europe. It was written by the great New York Times journalist Cyrus Sulzberger, who was well acquainted with Europe both before and during the war. Anyway, this is what he wrote. Europe is in a condition which no American can hope to comprehend. Virtually every ancient hatred has been revived with a new intensity. Frenchman, Italian, Russian, Pole, Czech, Serb, Greek, Belgian, Netherlander, Romanian, each in his own way hates the German with a personal frenzy. But worse, and not to be ignored, is that hatred renewed by the present war of Greek for Bulgar, Serb for Croat, Romanian for Hungarian, Frenchman for Italian, and Pole for Russian, which has developed among many population groups, basically and broadly united in the final effort to crush their common German enemy. And worst of all is that fratricidal hatred of Greek for Greek, Frenchman for Frenchman, Serb for Serb, and Pole for Pole, based on differing social and political conceptions, fostered and encouraged by chaos and unleashed by the war. Now today, Europe remembers all of these hatreds. Just as you or I might look back on our teenage years and remember all the bloody noses we got from our big brothers, or the underhanded way our little sisters connived to get us into trouble, so European countries still remember the squabbles that they had with one another during the war. Anti-German sentiment is still everywhere. In the 2013 Czech elections, one of the candidates was widely rejected by the electorate on the grounds that he had a German-sounding name. In 2012, Greek newspapers carried mocked-up pictures of the German Chancellor wearing a Nazi uniform, while Italian newspapers accused today's Germany of being the Fourth Reich. Now, all of these gripes with Germany have contemporary reasons, but the language that they're dressed up in is still the language of the Second World War. If 21st century students need a reason why the 20th century is still relevant today, they only need look at the way the war is constantly resurrected in European international relations. And actually, not only international relations, no student of politics could possibly understand the European political landscape without reference to the Second World War. How else can we understand the visceral anxiety that liberal French people feel at the rise of the far-right Front National? How else can we understand the way that Italian politicians still invoke Mussolini as a hero or a villain, even today? Once again, there are all sorts of other reasons for our constant comparisons to the Second World War, many of which have nothing to do with the past and everything to do with the present. But the fact that we always remember this time, above all other times, is not a coincidence. The Second World War has a universality that no other period in our history can compete with. Its shadow hangs over everything that we do, whether we like it or not. And what about at a world level? How is the war seen on the in the biggest group that there is, this universal group that we call humanity? Well, once again, the war is regarded as a kind of symbolic apocalypse. When the world's statesmen gather together in places like Normandy to commemorate the war, what they collectively remember is a sense of waste, of destroyed innocence, of martyred humanity. The message is always the same, that the war was such a global catastrophe that it must never be allowed to happen again. And I haven't counted the number of times I've heard that phrase in speeches about the Second World War or the Holocaust, but it must be dozens or even hundreds of times. Never again is probably the most common phrase in all of our commemorations. The language and the imagery invoked on the world stage is, once again, very similar to the language and imagery that's used by smaller groups. We still hear stories of victims and perpetrators, of right versus wrong, of good versus evil. But once again, the power of the group has focused and simplified these stories. At a world level, we only have one real archetypal victim, the Jew. And we only have one real archetypal perpetrator, the Nazi. I don't think it's any coincidence that the Jews of 1945 did not belong to any one particular nation. They belong to all nations. They're therefore a victim that we can all relate to. And I don't think that it's any coincidence either that the villains we've collectively chosen to demonise above all others is a political group that no longer exists. So we can hate the Nazis with all our hearts and souls, and it does no harm to anyone. And as a side note, I have to emphasise that on the world stage, the Nazis are always kept scrupulously separate from the Germans. As the French President François Hollande said in his address to the world leaders at Normandy this year, Germans were also the victims of Nazism. Now, some national groups have, of course, questioned these two global archetypes. When the United Nations debated the institution of an International Holocaust Memorial Day in 2005, the Chinese and the South Koreans both complained that, of course, the Jews weren't the only victims of the war and the Nazis weren't the only villains. But they were kind of missing the point, because on the world stage, there's no room for all the complicated realities of who did what to whom. Holocaust Remembrance Day is a symbol, nothing more. As the Armenian delegate said during the same debate, we are all Jews. He might also have added by extension that we are all Nazis. At a world level, we didn't experience the Second World War as an external conflict, but as an internal one. The war was indeed an apocalypse, but it was one that ripped us apart from the inside. And it's this that our world leaders want to avoid happening again at all costs. Excuse me. Now, I have talked a lot about the war as a symbolic apocalypse here, and I can understand if you're feeling a little bit confused. I mean, after all, this talk is supposed to be about myths of rebirth, not myths of destruction. And as Americans, you might be doubly confused, because, you know, most Americans don't look back at the war as any kind of apocalypse at all. Sure, you have Pearl Harbor, but that isn't the dominant American image of what the war meant. And though the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki might have looked like an apocalypse to Japan, from an American point of view, the dominant narrative has always been that they saved more lives than they took. So the Second World War didn't make you into martyrs or monsters, and it was not an apocalypse. Quite the contrary, for Americans, the Second World War was the start of something magnificent because it made you into heroes. I want to read you something else now, something that Bill Clinton said during the commemoration of the 50th anniversary of VE Day in 1995. I can't do the accent, so just imagine it. This is one of the stories that he told. He said, "During the war's final weeks, America's fighting forces thundered across Europe, liberating small villages and great cities from a long nightmare. Many witnessed an outpouring of love and gratitude they would remember for the rest of their lives. Deep in the Bavarian countryside, Corporal Bill Ellington piloted his armored vehicle into a battle against retreating enemy troops. As a firefight raged, a rail-thin teenage boy ran, shouting, towards the tank. He was a young Polish Jew, Samuel Pizar, who had survived 4 years at Auschwitz and other concentration camps, but along the way had lost his entire family. Samuel Pizar had seen the tank and its glorious five-point white star from his hideaway in a barn. As Ellington looked down at him, the boy dropped to his knees and repeated over and over again the few words of English that his mother had taught him. God bless America, God bless America. And Ellington, the son of a slave, lifted the boy through the hatch and into the warm embrace of freedom." What a story. I love that story. It's a piece of real oratorical brilliance. This is It is America as the saviour not only of Jews, but of black people and, by extension, all oppressed minorities wherever and whenever they've been. America didn't experience an apocalypse in 1945. On the contrary, America saved the world from that apocalypse. When Americans think back to the images of children in the ruins of Europe or Southeast Asia, it's not the ruins that they see, it's the children themselves. In other words, not what has been destroyed, but what has been saved. In American eyes, the Second World War was not merely a destructive event, it was also the event that swept away all that was evil in the world and which laid the foundations for something new, something better to grow. This, too, is, of course, mythology. Not the mythology of martyrdom, but the mythology of heroism. But it's a much more hopeful mythology because its central image is not one of destruction, but one of salvation. Wounds can be healed. Cities can be rebuilt. It's not only America that has always seen the war in these terms. I mean, to a certain degree, everyone did, and everyone still does. Even those very same people who mythologized the war as some kind of symbolic apocalypse. Almost all of the images of the apocalypse that I mentioned earlier are double-edged. Noah's flood, Armageddon, Vishnu's scorching of the universe. All of these are myths not only of destruction, but of rebirth. Even those who saw their world torn apart often understood that the tragedy they had experienced simultaneously offered them a way out. In 1945, everyone wanted to believe in this myth of rebirth, whatever group they identified themselves with. The inhabitants of destroyed towns and cities wanted nothing more than to rebuild them. And across the world, town after town and city after city was rebuilt using the same language about resurrection and rebirth and phoenixes rising from the ashes. Nations did likewise, whether they were on the winning side of the war or the losing side. Germany, for example, called 1945 Year Zero, the implication being that all that had gone before had been wiped away, and Germans would have to rebuild civilization again from scratch. Japan did something similar and embarked on a sustained period of deliberately forgetting the past and reinventing themselves for the future. On the opposite side, the Allies also saw themselves as reborn because of the war. Britain, for example, spent the entire war fighting for what they believed were eternal British values. And yet, as soon as the war was over, the first thing they did was to abandon traditionalism and elect a government who promised to change the whole structure of British society. The Labour government of 1945 was nothing like the Labour governments we've seen in recent years. They sought nothing less than to create what they called the New Jerusalem. For America, too, the war was a rebirth. Gone was the sleeping, depressed giant of the pre-war years. 1945 saw a nation transformed into a confident, booming economy and a world superpower. The Second World War was the beginning of what was called at the time, and has been called ever since, the American century. Even the victims of the war managed to see 1945 as a kind of rebirth. In Europe, they purged themselves of collaborators and fascists and called themselves new. In Asia, they threw off the imperialist yoke and started the process that saw colonial dominoes toppling all around the world. All of this was only made possible because of World War II. But perhaps the greatest rebirth of all happened on a global scale. The Second World War was the impetus that led to the creation of all our most important international institutions: the European Union, the International Criminal Court, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the United Nations itself. All of these organizations not only owe their existence to the Second World War, they continually mythologize their birth in the fires of that war. It's difficult to find any major speech or document coming from the EU or the UN that doesn't make reference to the fact that they were born out of the ashes of World War II. And to this day, the United Nations Security Council chamber is dominated by a huge mural of a phoenix rising from the rubble of warfare. Now, so strong are these images of the apocalypse, followed by a resurrection, that they've swallowed up many other myths that we used to have about the 20th century. In the old Soviet Union, the communists always used to consider 1917 the beginning of their century. Even after the Second World War, the 1917 revolution was always pushed as their foundation myth. But over time, this began to change. By the 1960s, the number of Soviet films and books about the Second World War began to increase exponentially. Memorials to the war began to open up all across the country. And the celebration of Victory Day became a national event for the first time. Bit by bit, 1917 was receding into the background, and 1945 was becoming more important. By the mid-1980s, it was easily the Second World War that loomed largest in the Soviet understanding of history. Just like in the West, it was considered both their biggest catastrophe and their greatest victory. And today, of course, this process is complete. The Soviet Union's no more. European communism is no more. 1917 is all but forgotten. When the heirs of the Soviet Union look back on their 20th century, the date they all see is 1945. For Russian nationalists, this is the greatest moment in Russian history, the moment when the great patriotic war came to an end and Russia exploded onto the world stage as a brand new superpower. A similar shift in mythology and memory has occurred pretty much everywhere. The Second World War has replaced lots of our other foundation myths. It's become a sort of universal foundation myth, the Big Bang out of which we were all formed. Historians are so used to peddling a meta-narrative about the 20th century as this kind of bell curve, this long, slow rise to the war and then the long descent back to normality, that we've kind of failed to notice that for most people, this meta-narrative is a different shape altogether. Most people in today's world spare few thoughts for the pre-war period at all. Or rather, when they do think about it, they tend to relegate it to that dusty pile of old dates and events that we call history. 1945, on the other hand, is very often regarded not merely as the past. It's the very foundation of who we are today. It was 1945 that gave us jet planes and modern computers and the birth of the atomic age. It was 1945 that gave us human rights and the Pax Americana and the golden economic age of Bretton Woods. It launched the Cold War and the space race. It created Israel and all the problems that we see in the Middle East today. It started the process of decolonization. It gave new meanings to the words West and East, a new definition to our concepts of good and evil. The Second World War gave us so many turning points that it's easy to hang just about any idea upon it. And so this is what we do. Whether we look back at our past with the eyes of a scientist or a lawyer, an artist or an architect, a philosopher or a politician. Now, my purpose here today has not been to endorse this meta-narrative, but merely to describe it. In lots of ways, it's only really an illusion, a story that we've told ourselves in order to make sense of our communal past. Like any other model of the 20th century, it has its faults, the most important of which is the way that it has dominated our imagination at the cost of many other important stories about our history. But the fact that we're all so seduced by this illusion is, I think, significant in itself. I mean, we'd all like to believe that there's a single story which unites us all, that explains all our hopes and fears, that describes all our relationships with one another. At a global level, this overarching narrative has been promoted to do exactly this, to draw us into imagining that we're all as good or as bad as each other, and that we are all part of one global family. It's quite a noble idea on the whole. But it will only work so long as all of us carry on believing it. Was the Second World War really an apocalypse? In reality, many parts of the world didn't experience it this way. And did it signify a rebirth? Actually, there are just as many continuities as there were changes after the war. In the tapestry view of 20th century history, World War II might seem like a rip in the fabric, but many of the threads that were severed start again on the other side of that tear. Now, some of the other lectures in this series will describe how significant these continuities were. But psychologically speaking, mythologically speaking, the 20th century began for us in 1945. And it ended, well, that's another story altogether. Perhaps it ended in the 1990s or on 9/11, or perhaps it hasn't even ended yet. I really think that it's probably too early to tell. We can only hope that when future generations look back on the end of the 20th century, they speak in metaphors about hope and not in metaphors about catastrophe. Thank you very much.
I'd like to pursue a little bit this notion of apocalypse and rebirth, but push you a little bit on whether or not it centers on the Second World War in a couple of ways. First of all, the whole notion of a Second World War is a construct. It seems to me in many respects the European War and the Pacific War deserve to be seen as quite distinct events in a myriad of ways. And in the context of your talk, it ought to be done, in particular because I think you're overstating the significance of 1939, 1945 for the Europeans.
Right.
For the Europeans, it's really a 30 years war. Their apocalypse is the apocalypse of 1914 to 1945. And indeed, it seems to me when you travel around Europe and you're looking for museums and monuments, I mean, when I lived in Germany, as many monuments to the fallen of World War I as to the fallen of World War II. So it's two different apocalypses on opposite sides of the world. And then to take the point you touched on right at the end, there are any number of peoples that we can point to for whom World War II really is not the central event, is not their apocalypse. For the Vietnamese, it's not an apocalypse. For the Vietnamese, I would think the apocalypse is maybe the French Indochina War, but certainly the American War. That's for them the moment of great suffering that, yes, led to rebirth.
But for the Vietnamese...
For the Arabs, I'll finish here. But for the Arabs, the apocalypse is not World War II. The Nakba is 1948. That's their apocalypse, and from their perspective, the rebirth has not yet happened. And in that sense, their 20th century actually still continues. So what I'm trying to say is it possible to get somewhere, to stick with your notion of apocalypse and rebirth as an organizing theme, but not be quite so determined to stick it to the events of 1939 to 1945?
I see. Okay, well, I take your point about somewhere like Vietnam or the Middle East not experiencing the war as an apocalypse, but they certainly experienced a rebirth afterwards. I mean, the Vietnamese Declaration of Independence was in 1945, and it was based on the American Declaration of Independence. So there was a feeling that you know, this was a all across Asia. That this was a moment of huge change. It was their opportunity to shake off the shackles of imperialism and so on. But you are right. I mean, there was much more concentrated devastation in Europe, and you probably gathered from the way I delivered the talk that you know, I was concentrating a lot more on Europe than I was on Asia, and that's my area of speciality, if you like. So yeah, I think there is some scope for separating the two, but they were interlinked conflicts. I mean, the European war was, you know, the Europeans were closely bound up with what was going on in the Far East as well, and the two situations did feed each other. For example, there was a massive famine in India, which was caused by the war in Europe to a certain degree, because food wasn't being sent to the right people, and because of the way that the sort of global food distribution services were destroyed by the war. So there were sort of local apocalypses, if you like. I also want to draw a distinction between, you know, the different levels that I talked about. I mean, you have an individual level, and you've got a sort of a communal level, and different communal levels going all the way up to a sort of world level. And although in some parts of Asia, or I mean, think about South America. I mean, they had no apocalypse at all. They were barely involved in the Second World War, but they still have a sense, if they associate themselves with the global community, they still have a sense of a sort of global apocalypse, if you like. So it kind of depends on which level of group that you associate yourself with, depending on which nation you are.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by British author and historian Keith Lowe. His lecture was titled The Phoenix Century, Myths of Rebirth from the Ashes of World War II, and was presented by the Boston University History Department. Tonight's moderator was History Department Chair Bruce Shulman. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from James Trout. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.